I'd like to work a little more with the with relevance and material as we work with Isaiah 9. And I think probably we better go ahead and get started. So Isaiah 9 verses 1 to 7. And I want to deal with two questions there, basically. Well, really three. What is our usual understanding of that passage? Secondly, what does the passage mean in its own time and place using historical critical tools? I'll explain what I mean by that. One, what's our usual understanding of that passage? Secondly, using historical critical tools, what's a likely understanding of that passage in its own historical setting? If I was back in 700 in the time of Isaiah, how would those people understand it? And then the third question, what's the relevance of that material for us out of a historical critical approach? Okay, what's the relevance of Isaiah 9, 1-7 for us if we use a historical critical approach? Would someone read that passage? Someone have a, I guess any translation is fine. Isaiah 9, verses 1-7. Anybody?
The land of the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali was once disgraced, but the future will bring honor to this region. From the Mediterranean eastward to the land on the other side of the Jordan, and even to Galilee itself, where the foreigners lived. People who walked in darkness have seen a great light. They lived in the land of shadows, but now light is shining on them. You have given them great joy, Lord. You have made them happy. They rejoice in what you have done, as people rejoice when they harvest grain or when they divide captured wealth. For you have broken the yoke that burdened them, and the rod that beat their shoulders. You have defeated the nation that oppressed and exploited your people, just as you defeated the army of Midian long ago. The boots of the invading army and all their blood-stained clothing will be destroyed by fire. A child is born to us, a son is given to us, and he will be our ruler. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. His royal power will continue to grow. His kingdom will always be at peace. He will rule as King David's successor, basing his power on the right and justice from now until the end of time. The Lord Almighty is determined to do all this.
Okay, that last passage we know out of, I think, probably still most of us out of King James and out of the Messiah, out of Handel's Messiah. Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. The government will be upon his shoulders, and so on. So, we're working now into the matter of differences of approach to biblical studies and the effects of different approach. Let's start out with this. Typically, how do we understand that passage? I'm not asking, you know, it's not a judgmental question, it's not a right or wrong, but typically, how do we understand it?
Prophecy.
And prophecy meaning?
Of the Messiah.
Okay, prophecy meaning prediction of?
Yes.
Messiah, Messiah understood as?
Jesus.
As, okay, a divine being, Jesus. Right?
Right.
So that's what we've all come up with, I think, as an understanding of that. A prophet as a predictor, a Messiah, a supernatural or divine deliverer. Isaiah, speaking of a coming supernatural deliverer. It's again a passage we're familiar with generally from Advent season and the Messiah and so on. It means a whole bunch to us. Now hang loose for a while, and it's going to take, I'm seeing, more time than I had thought, but I'd like to develop this for a while. And don't worry about where it goes. We'll talk about the implications of it all later on. So don't get excited about things being thrown out. They're not being thrown out. But it's going to take some time to develop another kind of understanding. If you have a contemporary translation, it's a lot easier to follow. The King James on verse 1 there, if that's what you have in your hands there, the King James on verse 1 is, I think, just extremely difficult to make sense out of. There are several different versions in the room, but a contemporary translation is, I think, helpful in two regards. For one thing, a contemporary translation will probably put the passage in what form? Prose or poetry? prose, okay? Verse 1 is a prose introduction. And verses 2 through 7 in a good contemporary English translation are written as poetry. So verse 1, a prose introduction, 2 to 7, poetry. And let's locate now on verse 1. What I'm doing is giving a typical, not the only one, but a typical historical critical approach to this particular passage. A historical critical interpretation of Isaiah 9, 1 through 7. And we need to spend a bunch of time on verse 1. My translation here reads, "For while the first invader has dealt lightly with the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, the second has dealt heavily with Galilee of the nations on the road beyond the Jordan to the sea." Read your first verse over there, please. That translation, I think, is more helpful. Yeah.
"The land of the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali was once disgraced, but the future will bring honor to this region, from the Mediterranean eastward to the land on the other side of the Jordan, and even to Galilee itself, where the foreigners live."
Does anybody have an Oxford or an RSV, a regular Revised Standard Version? Would you read the verse, please, out of the Revised Standard?
"There will be no gloom for her that was in anguish. In the former time he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the latter time he will make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations."
Okay, out of the different ones we've listened to, and then also including the King James some of you are reading, I think the Oxford is, or the Revised Standard Version there is really the most helpful. "There will be no gloom for her that was in anguish. The land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali, Galilee of the nations, the way of the sea." Okay, we need to talk a little about the geographical historical settings of that first verse gets us into. It's a passage generally considered to be from Isaiah of Jerusalem. Isaiah of Jerusalem began his ministry in the year that King Uzziah died, 742, and extends down, nobody's quite sure, somewhere probably after 700 B.C. So that historical setting. Now let's work a little bit with those geographical references there in the first verse. Land of Zebulun, land of Naphtali. Zebulun and Naphtali were what? Tribes in ancient Israel. Their country was set up not in terms of states, but in terms of tribal districts. But pushing a little bit further, where are the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali located? Okay? I don't know what all you can see here. I hope you can see a little bit. This is a very exact scale map of. Here's the Mediterranean out here, and the Nile, and the Dead Sea, and the Galilee, the Persian Gulf, Mesopotamia over here. Okay, the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali, roughly this area, up around the Galilee, the tribal districts up in this area, Zebulun and Naphtali. The way of the sea, another distinct reference. How many of you came out on Interstate 90, 94? Okay, people coming from the Midwest. The way of the sea is also a distinct reference. If I say Highway 90, everybody knows what it means. In ancient Israel, if you said the way of the sea, everybody knew what you meant. The way of the sea, then, the route, the major route between the two primary parts of the Fertile Crescent. The way of the sea, then, the road that extends up along the coast, okay, from the Nile down here, from Egypt up along the coast. Now, again, we need to talk a little bit more about the geographical setting. Somewhere back in junior high, everybody learns about the Fertile Crescent. The Fertile Crescent, this arc of land extending from the Tigris-Euphrates valleys over here to the Nile Valley over here. The two major civilizations in the Fertile Crescent, the Egyptian or Nile civilization down here and the Mesopotamian civilizations over here. What's in between? Israel and Egypt, again hassling over what's down here. The Sinai, really god-awful barren territory. What's over here? Saudi Arabia, Jordan, again the Arabian Desert, extremely barren territory, much of it. Okay, the two major ends of the Fertile Crescent, here and here. If there is to be communication between here and here, in ancient times, most people didn't want to cut across the deserts. There are a few routes there, but that was for a few hardy adventurous souls, and it was really difficult going. The primary way of moving from here to here was to follow the easy route, the way of the sea. Okay, the way of the sea, up along the coast where it's smooth, easy going. But there's a problem. Starting way up in Lebanon and extending all the way down until they peter out in the Negev and the Sinai, there's a spiny mountain ridge that runs along the length of the country. rugged snow-capped mountains up here, becoming more and more gradual as you go south until they peter out down in the Negev. So that gives a problem. The way of the sea gives you a good smooth route for a while, but you've got to get across the mountains. And in order to get across the mountains, then you need to find a hole in them, a valley. And up around where today the Carmel Peninsula juts out into the Mediterranean, where today there is the city of Haifa, in the territories in ancient Israel of Zebulun and Naphtali, there are some valleys, Esdraelon, Jezreel, Plain of Megiddo, that cut from the coast to the interior. So from time immemorial, one of the most strategic places in this whole landmass is the territory up here where the valleys cut from the coast to the interior. There's more valleys like that up farther north, but in this particular setting, the easiest and best route then to cut from the way of the sea, from that highway, across the valleys and on over into Mesopotamia. So what I'm saying is this is strategically all important. Megiddo, today the Tell of Megiddo, the site there, 22 civilizations or 22 cities built one on top of the other, 22 layers of cities at Megiddo. From way back about 3000 BC, an important strategic site for guarding those valleys, for controlling access in and out of those valleys. Not only way back, say 3500 BC, but as late as the Arab-Israeli conflicts in 1947-48, this territory particularly important. So control of the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, the way of the sea, who wants control? Going back into the time of Isaiah, over in Mesopotamia, the dominant power in Mesopotamia, periodically between about 1200 and 600, is Assyria. The ruler in Assyria, in this time we're talking about, 742 and following, Tiglath-Pileser. In college courses, I say you want good biblical names for your kids. You make a collection of names like Tiglath-Pileser is emperor in Assyria, and he's ambitious. He wants to extend his control of territory. And there's not much in between here and here that was important to him. But if he wants to extend control of territory, he's interested in heading to the other end of the Fertile Crescent. Controls Mesopotamia. There are a number of small little kingdoms in here, none of them particularly powerful. What Tiglath-Pileser wants to do is to move west. And about 740, 735 BC, everybody knows that. Tiglath-Pileser and the Assyrians are headed west. And if he's headed west, what's he going to want? He's going to want the easiest route. That means the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, the way of the sea. Okay, this has to be, in order to see where all this material is coming from, a kind of a history lesson for a while. There are a number of petty little or small little kingdoms in this territory. Israel, remember, is divided into two parts. They split over Davidic theology back in 920. Judah down here, Israel up here. So there are two kingdoms here. Judah, Israel, Edom over here, the Moabites, Damascus up here, the Canaanite or Phoenician city-states up to the north, Tyre, Byblos, Sidon, and so on. So there are a bunch of little kingdoms in that territory, none of them strong enough to do much with the Assyrians. And what they say, as becomes evident around 740, 735, that the Assyrians and Tiglath-Pileser are coming, they say, in essence, let's do what we did 100 years ago. Let's form a coalition. Let's form a coalition and block off Assyrian expansion. So back in 853, at the Battle of Karkar, these people had done just that. They formed a coalition and blocked Assyrian expansion. They say, let's do it again. Kind of like, if we hang separately, we indeed hang. Let's get together. So again, in 740, 735, an attempt to form a coalition. Everybody goes along with the coalition. The Canaanite states, the Damascus, and so on. Different small kingdoms go along with the coalition, except for Judah. Except for Judah. King down in Judah at this time is Ahaz. His date's roughly 735 to 715. And Ahaz, instead of joining the coalition to oppose Assyria, does a tricky thing. He goes over to Assyria and makes an alliance with Tiglath-Pileser. Okay? Whether he was simply smarter than the others and knew what was going to happen anyway, or whatever, we can't really say. But Ahaz goes to Assyria, and instead of joining the coalition, he forms an alliance with Tiglath-Pileser. Now again, we have to fit ourselves back into their world. If we in our country make a military alliance with, say, India, it doesn't mean we take on the Hindu religion. But for those people, life is more integrated. There's more of a focus and a center. There's no such thing as simply a military political alliance. There are always other kinds of overtones that they're very aware of and very sensitive to. So it turns out like this. Ahaz makes the alliance with Tiglath-Pileser. He comes back to Jerusalem, and he makes sacrifice to the Assyrian gods. Okay? To make a long story short, what's involved is this. If he's going to make an alliance with the Assyrians, he's also going to have to give at least a token acceptance of Assyrian religion. He's going to have to pay some attention to the Assyrian way of dealing with the questions of identity and direction. And who's not going to like that? Well, the religious leadership in Israel is going to become very upset. And one of the religious leaders in Israel at this time is the prophet Isaiah. Okay? The prophet Isaiah. Ahaz forms a coalition. Isaiah opposes it. He sees this as really opening up the gates for letting all of the Yahwistic way of living go right down the drain. Okay, reviewing then. The attempt at a coalition to block Assyrian expansion, Ahaz joining the Assyrians rather than the coalition. I would doubt that historically it would have made a great deal of difference anyway, but you know, we're beyond the point where we can say that. In any case, the Assyrians now come in. They do move west. They do take over and conquer these little kingdoms. Tyre, Byblos, Sidon, Edomites, Moabites, Israel, the northern kingdom. Okay? About 735, the Assyrians conquer the northern kingdom. They have a lot of trouble in the northern kingdom. The people there keep trying to maintain their independence, revolting, and so on. And so finally, down in about 725 BC, the Assyrians simply get tired of dealing with this tiny little kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom, and they come in and over about a three-year period simply level it. Okay? 725 to 722-21, the Assyrians demolish the northern kingdom, Israel, 5/6 of the Hebrew nation. Those who don't flee or get killed are packed off by the Assyrians. The end of the northern kingdom. The end of Zebulun and Naphtali. Okay, so this gives us some explanation then for what's going on in verse 1, that prose introduction. Zebulun and Naphtali have fallen into disrepair. They've gotten into trouble. But what's the tone of that first verse? He's saying things have fallen apart, but they're going to get better. Okay? And that takes us up then to verses 2 through 7. We'll pick up with that tomorrow morning. Any questions before we close for today? Quick thing. Okay, tomorrow we'll focus on verses 2 through 7 and come down to the last, to focus particularly on the last line of verse 7. The last sentence of verse 7. And I'll pick up then and develop some different understandings of that last line.
What I'm working with in Bible studies over the 3 weeks I'll be here is like so. I'm saying there are choices within the Bible. I oftentimes think it would be really nice if we could go to the Bible and find simply one single set of nice and clear and complete answers. But as we look back into the biblical period, we find them also, just like us, dealing with variety and choice. And so we started out earlier in the week by taking a look at the story, Who Killed Goliath? And everybody knows, of course, the story that comes out of 1 Samuel 17 that says David killed Goliath. And hardly anybody, even though we have church backgrounds, knows about the story in 2 Samuel 21:19 that says Elhanan killed Goliath. And then there's also a third passage, 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, that says Elhanan killed the brother of Goliath. So what I've done in the preceding two sessions is to develop some of the background for that, and to and the group that was here talk about what are some of the ways that we might come to grips with these differences. And they vary a great deal, the ways we might resolve those differences. But I think we have to pay attention particularly to this kind of choice. Are the differences there accidental or on purpose? If they're on purpose, can we find out what the purpose or intention of the ancient writers might be? And so we talked about that over the first two sessions, and I was using that material to make this point. There are choices of ideas, theologies, viewpoints within the Bible itself. And I don't think that's bad. One of the things I've been pushing on is this. I don't think it's helpful to look at that material as contradictory, but rather we're looking back on a society as complex in a great many ways as our own. And instead of saying they're contradictions, I think it's much more helpful to view it as differences. I was saying, whoever was sitting next to me, we're not contradictory necessarily, we are different. And so within the biblical materials, we find differences of views and theologies. And finally, I think there are intentional differences of theology behind those different David stories. Then the second thing I was going into is this. There are also differences in approaches to the Bible. Again, I think it might be nice if there were only one way of approaching it. It would be much easier for us to find unanimity or agreement. But everybody in the room knows that has had the experience, I would imagine, of going to the same biblical passage and having their understanding or their interpretation of it, and finding out that the person next to them or next door or a member of the church down the street had a very different interpretation. In German academics, there's the term Fragestellung, and it means simply the way of putting questions. The way we put questions has a great deal to do with what kind of answers we're going to get. And this, I think, is behind some of the differences in our interpretation of the Bible. In biblical studies, it seems to me the first task is always this, to try to find out what the author had in mind. We can free associate with any kind of material and find all sorts of good ideas. But I think in going into biblical materials, it's very important for us to first of all try to find out what the author had in mind. The technical term for that is to exegete, or exegesis. And I think some ways of putting questions to the Bible, some approaches, are more helpful in finding out what the author had in mind than are others. But there are many differences in approaches to the Bible, many different ways of putting the questions, and depending on what way we put the questions, we'll come out with different kinds of understandings of what the passage means. I began to work with this with the passage out of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 to 7. Now, in my opinion, the most helpful translation of that is the Revised Standard Version. Does anybody have an RSV in the room? Could read this text? Yeah, if you'd read that, please. The Revised Standard Version, Isaiah 9, verses 1 to 7. We worked with the first verse on, 2 days ago? And today I'd like to pick up and work with verses 2 through 7 particularly.
But there will be no gloom for her that was in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, he will make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walk in darkness have seen great light. Those who dwelt in the land of deep darkness, on them a light that has light shined. Thou hast multiplied the nations, thou hast increased its joy. They rejoice before thee as with joy at the harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, thou hast broken, as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the trampling warrior in battle, helmet, and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness, from this time forth and forevermore, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this.
Okay, again, I'd like to repeat what I said at the end of my last session. I think it's important to pay particular attention to the last line that Dean read there. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. But we have some other things to do before we come back to that. Reviewing a little bit of what I was talking about in the last session that I had, we focus particularly on Isaiah chapter 9, verse 1. Before going into that, I said, how do we typically, or in quotes, traditionally, understand that passage? And traditionally, so-called, we typically understand that passage in Isaiah as Isaiah, the prophet, predicting the coming of Jesus. Okay, and we use it during Advent, Christmas season, And that's a choice, to see Isaiah back there forecasting or predicting the coming of Jesus. But there are other choices. And the way we understand the passage, I think, will be to a large degree determined by the kind of approach we choose to take. And again, I'm pushing on this kind of idea. I think that the most important thing is to try to find or to choose an approach to the Bible that will do the best job of getting us back into what the passage meant in its own time and place. Then from that point, we can talk about the relevance of those ideas for our own situation. But I think it's very important for us not to foist our own ideas down on top of the text, but rather to try to lay bare what the author himself, in his own time and place, would mean. And in getting into that, I was talking about Isaiah chapter 9, there, verse 1 last time. And there's not the time to review all of it, but just very quickly, I was pointing to the geographical and historical allusions in that passage. The Fertile Crescent, the dominant power in the Fertile Crescent at that time, Assyria. Assyria, about 740, 735 BC, under Tiglath-Pileser, moving west, wanting to gain control of the whole of the Fertile Crescent, down into Egypt. The major road between the two dominant ends of the Fertile Crescent, Egypt and Mesopotamia, the major road was the Way of the Sea. It cut smoothly up along the coast of the Mediterranean, and then it had to go over the mountain ridge that runs from Lebanon on down until it peters out in the rugged, barren Negev Sinai. And to go from coast to interior, you have to cross the mountains. The best place to cross, or one of the best places to cross, is in the tribal territories of Zebulun and Naphtali, up in the north around the Galilee, stretching from what is today Haifa in towards the Sea of Galilee. So that territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, the Way of the Sea, are geographical references in that first verse. And the author is talking about these territories having fallen into gloom, into despair. Something bad has happened. Well, a bad thing that happened was that the Assyrians came stomping in there. And part of the whole process was an alliance formed between Judah, the southern kingdom of Israel, and the empire of Assyria. This helped Assyria to move in, expand, take that territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, control the Way of the Sea. Isaiah the prophet is very upset because Ahaz, king of Judah, the southern kingdom, the Hebrew nation is divided into two parts at this time, again, as we were talking about over the last sessions. Ahaz, king of Judah, the southern territory, instead of joining a coalition to block Assyrian expansion, has gone to the Assyrians and made an alliance. This alliance with the Assyrians in those days could not be simply a political or military alliance. Rather, they think more holistically. So when Ahaz comes back from Assyria, he has to bring with him at least a token acceptance of Assyrian religion. And that means not just a new shape for the altar or a new church on a new corner, but rather it means taking up new ways of dealing with the religious questions, the questions of identity and direction. So Isaiah of Jerusalem, Isaiah the prophet, is very upset. Ahaz has made inroads for a whole different way of looking at life from that Isaiah thinks is true and correct. And so there's a radical clash we see throughout this section of Isaiah between Isaiah the prophet and Ahaz the king. Okay, that for review. Now going quickly, we'll have to move kind of fast with this, but anytime you want, interrupt or make comments. If there are terms or whatever that I use that need clarification, please say so. Now I'm taking a particular kind of approach that I'll be talking about as we continue next week into this material, and I'm going to be referring now to some of the findings of what's called form criticism, a form critical study of Isaiah verses 9 verses 2 through 7. Everybody in the room has had English classes. The English teacher says, tomorrow write an essay. And so the English teacher gives the assignment, write an essay, and tomorrow you bring in a limerick or a lyric poem. And anybody knows that's kind of a dumb thing to do. We know there are different literary forms, essays, short stories, novels, lyric poems, epic poems, and so on and so on. But a thing we're not generally aware of is that the ancient people also had different literary forms. And one of the really neat things that's come out of biblical studies in the last century, roughly, is the knowledge of what their literary forms were like. Now, if you have a contemporary translation of Isaiah 9 before you there, in most contemporary translations, verse 1 is written as prose, and verses 2 through 7 are written as poetry. But, again, it's more sophisticated than that. The ancient people are more sophisticated than that. Verses 2 through 7 are not simply poetry, but they're a hymn. Okay? Now here, there's not obviously not time to give the details and linguistic arguments and so on for that, but simply conclusions. Isaiah 9, 2 through 7, a hymn, and more specifically, a particular kind of hymn, a coronation hymn, a coronation hymn. Some of us remember when Elizabeth II was crowned Queen of England, Queen of Britain. And we remember that, for example, Benjamin Britten wrote coronation music for Queen Elizabeth. The same sort of thing in the ancient world. Isaiah 9, 2 through 7 is a coronation hymn, a hymn written for the crowning of a king. Okay, there's some other things that need to be said, I think, about this particular passage. Ahaz has, by his way of thinking, sold out the country and has brought inroads for an entirely new kind of religion. We know also from a bunch of material in the Bible that Isaiah placed great hopes on the king who succeeded Ahaz. That is a king by the name of Hezekiah, whose dates are roughly 735, or rather 715, on down to about 685. So Isaiah thought Ahaz was a bad king. He had sold out. He thought Hezekiah was a good king. Now we're into conjecture, as is often the case in biblical studies, but I think conjecture with good substantial basis behind it. Isaiah 9, 2 through 7 is a coronation hymn, and a number of scholars suggest that it's a coronation hymn that Isaiah intended for the crowning of Hezekiah. A coronation hymn intended for the crowning of Hezekiah. Because we do know that Isaiah placed great hopes with Hezekiah, and he thought Hezekiah would straighten out, or rather more accurately, that Yahweh, God of Israel, through Hezekiah, would straighten out what Ahaz had fouled up. And so many scholars, instead of seeing Isaiah 9, 1 through 7, as a prediction of the coming of Jesus, see it as a passage located in its own time and place, the time of trouble with the Assyrians, Ahaz selling off, the hopes that Isaiah has for Hezekiah, the hopes that God, through Hezekiah, will make for a new direction for Israel, for the Hebrew people. Going down to verses 6 and 7. In verses 6 and 7, we find that passage that turns up so often in Christmas cards. Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. The government will be upon his shoulders. His name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, for us, out of our background, I think we think of those terms as supernatural attributes, or terms that one would apply to the divine offspring of a deity. But going back into ancient history, we find that those are simply typical throne titles. Throne titles. When you read ancient literature, whether it's biblical or otherwise, and somebody's talking about the king, for example, in the Assyrian literature from the time, there are usually a whole list of names for the king. King such and such of Assyria. And then it'll give maybe as many as 10 or 12 throne titles to try to characterize or magnify or glorify this figure. King Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria, High Muckety-Muck, and so on and so on and so on. Israel did this also. Throne titles that would try to characterize not necessarily what that king was like, but what they hoped he would be like. Okay? And so something like Everlasting Father. Again, I think can perhaps be translated more accurately, will always treat his people like a father. The nature of his relationship between him and his subjects will be that of father and child. Mighty God. Again, I think, getting at the sense of it more accurately, he will rule with divine support. Not this will be a divine being, but rather he will rule with divine support. So, in its own time and place, they're not necessarily supernatural attributes, but rather simply throne titles, and rather typical ones at that, describing a king that this particular writer hopes will come and straighten out what the other king, Ahaz, has done wrong. Hezekiah did try to break the alliance with the Assyria. He was manifestly unsuccessful, but Isaiah gave him good grades for at least attempting to straighten out what Ahaz had done wrong. So some other things in background of this and in support of this particular understanding. So we have Isaiah 9, verse 1, giving us the historical setting, the bad times, the Assyrians, Ahaz. Verses 2 through 7, a coronation hymn, and a statement of hope. A statement of hope. Perhaps Yahweh, through this new king, will straighten out the fortunes and directions of Israel. Yeah.
It seems like the wording for to us a child is born would be out of place in reference to Hezekiah.
How so?
Well, Hezekiah is already alive.
Yeah, it could be, I think, again, translated or understood like this. There has come among us this new being, this person. Child is used in the Bible not only for little babies, but for adults as well. Okay. So there's come then this new figure. On him we place our hopes. He'll straighten things out. Or rather, Yahweh through him will make for a new kind of world. Yeah.
Is it possible to, you know, that this is really both things? I mean, not, you know, we don't have to really choose one or the other, but that through the inspiration of Isaiah, he maybe was writing something that could be the coronation hymn at that time, but without his necessarily knowing it, was the prediction of the Messiah.
Okay, we get a whole bunch of choices. One would be to try to say both a coronation hymn in his own time and place and the prediction. I'd like to say some more things relating to that. Again, a problem is I have no idea what your backgrounds are in biblical studies, but the word prophet, as it's used in our society, and the word prophet, as it's used in the biblical period, are, I think, quite different. When we say prophet, we think usually, automatically, of somebody who predicts. In our local paper on what is it, December 31st, there's always a full page of Gene Dixon's predictions for the next year. And Gene Dixon is seen as prophet, somebody who forecasts what's coming up. But a prophet in the biblical period simply is not primarily a predictor of the future. The word prophet comes out of the Greek, and a prophet literally is simply one who speaks for someone else. Prophet means literally one who speaks for someone else. We can get the biblical sense of a prophet, I think, very clearly by going back to a passage in Exodus. You remember the story of the Exodus and Moses being drafted to lead the people out of Egypt. And you remember Moses didn't like that very well. He had all sorts of objections. And you recall one of his objections was, I don't speak very well. Okay, remember that? Exodus chapter 7, verse 1 is very interesting and very helpful in seeing what a prophet is like in the biblical period. Yahweh says to Moses, Aaron your brother will be your prophet. Aaron your brother will be your prophet. Exodus 7, verse 1. So Yahweh is meeting Moses' objections. He's saying, so you don't speak so well, you don't have to. Aaron will do the speaking for you. So not Aaron will be your predictor, but Aaron will be your spokesman. So a prophet, not someone who predicts the future, but rather someone who speaks for someone else. A prophet of Yahweh, Yahweh's spokesman. and the thrust of prophecy, like so, a prophet is somebody who is about the business of doing the truth. Of doing the truth. Those people, I think, take words more seriously than we do. The prophet of Yahweh is a bearer of Yahweh's words. And he takes very seriously the idea that if he will stand up and speak among the people Yahweh's word, things will happen. So doing the truth through speaking Yahweh's word. The prophets do talk about the future, and I hope we can get into talking about this a little more next week, a little more directly. But a couple of things. One, when they talk about the future, they're not always so accurate. The book of Nahum, for example, around 612, the fall of Assyria, a little passage in the second chapter, Nahum says, now that Nineveh, capital of Assyria, has fallen, the house of Jacob will rise. This is 612. Within about 30 years, the house of Jacob is totally leveled, wiped out. Haggai and Zechariah say, about 520, during a very chaotic period in the Persian Empire, rebuild the temple, show Yahweh you're serious, and Yahweh will rebuild the house of Israel through the Davidic king Zerubbabel. What happens to the house of David, Zerubbabel, in the period following 520? Again, collapse, nothing. Now, I think the problem is ours and not that of the biblical people. They didn't retain Nahum's material because Nahum was good at predicting. They didn't keep Haggai and Zechariah because they gave an accurate forecast of what was coming up. But rather they kept them because of the theological ideas they threw in front of Israel. The hopes, the dreams, the expectations, the analysis of problems, the calls into new possibilities. But they know better than us that sometimes what the prophets said was going to happen didn't happen. So the weight of their interest in the prophets didn't fall on the business of prediction. I think it's very helpful to look at the prophets and predictions this way. The prophets, in their talking about the future, are talking about the future they see growing out of and pinching in on the present. They're talking about the future they see growing out of, pinching in on, their own concrete present situation. Thus, for example, Amos about 750 BC in Israel, a time of peace and prosperity. Things are going well. Amos must have been looked on really as a wild man, an idiot. In the middle of that peace and prosperity, he went around the country saying things are going to fall apart, you're going to collapse. And he said, why? Not I've got a crystal ball or I've got some supernatural and magical information, but rather simply, the rich sell the poor for a pair of shoes. You can buy any judge in the country, and so on. So what Amos is saying is, live like this and this will happen, because this is what Yahweh is like. And Yahweh runs things, not people. So when people live against what Yahweh expects, things fall apart. So the prophets, when they talk about the future, a couple of things. One, they talk about the future pinching in on and growing out of the present. And secondly, they're not always so accurate in their forecasting, but ancient Israel knows that better than we do. They keep them because of their theological insights, not because of their accuracy in predicting. Other things. A prophet then, not primarily a predictor, but a doer of the truth, a spokesman for Yahweh. The idea of Messiah. We look at Isaiah 9, verses 1 to 7 as a messianic passage. But one of the speakers yesterday was talking about the meaning of the word Messiah. Messiah means simply anointed one. Every king in Israel was Messiah. Cyrus the Persian is referred to in the book of Isaiah as Yahweh's Messiah. Kings, prophets, priests can all be referred to legitimately as messiahs. And the term doesn't take on the kind of overtones we've given it until a period much later than Isaiah. A little bit about their worldview back in Isaiah's time. Isaiah thinks like this. The cosmos is in three layers. Heaven is up, hell is down, and the earth is in between. In Isaiah's period, when you die, what happens? When you die, you go down to the third layer, down to Sheol. What happens then? Nothing. Period. That's it. In Isaiah's period, back in 700 BC in Israel, they don't think in terms of resurrection and judgment. They think in terms of death, and with death you go down to Sheol, which is a kind of storehouse for the dead. You're not totally out of the picture, but you don't get out of there either. What I'm saying is there's no resurrection and judgment back in Isaiah's period. That comes a lot later. And now what are the implications of that? Well, if Isaiah thinks in terms of Messiah being an anointed one and his focus would be on a king figure, if he thinks when you die you go to Sheol and that's it, for Isaiah, if things are going to get straightened out, they're going to get straightened out on this earth or not at all, not somewhere on the other side of the grave in heaven. So again, all of this, I think, works together. Our understanding of the historical geographical setting, their literary form, a coronation hymn, the specific problems, Ahaz, Hezekiah, a prophet not primarily a predictor, but a preacher, a spokesman for Yahweh. Their understanding of Messiah, their understanding of what happens when I die. So all of this put together means Isaiah is really locked into his own time. And he's talking about problems and possibilities in his own time. And we have to remember that, I think, very carefully as we go back into that material. That brings us to the second point I want to work with this morning. And that's the question then. So if we see it as a prediction, taking those two basic approaches we've looked at, we see it in so-called traditional way. We see it as Isaiah, a prophet, predicting the coming of Jesus 700 years later. What's the relevance of the passage then? I suppose something like this. It becomes part of a whole system of guarantees. The prophet predicts, it happens, therefore it's true. Okay? A way in which we guarantee or try to underwrite the correctness of Christianity. What happens if we see Isaiah 9, not in terms of that kind of prediction, but in terms of him talking about his own specific problems in his own situation? Those are not our problems. We don't have to deal with Ahaz, the Assyrians. But what relevance to the material?
And here I'd like to return to that last line. I think there are two basic things of theological relevance in Isaiah 9, 1 through 7, if we see it in its own time and situation, rather than as forecast. One thing, I think it's a really neat passage that would be worth considering seriously when we talk about political science. Again, what Isaiah is doing there is he's saying, this is what a good ruler would look like. He will rule not by himself, but with God's backing. He will treat his people as a father, and so on. Okay? So we could spend some time there, but I'd rather take the few minutes we've got and spend it on that last line, which seems to me to be really the key to the theological relevance of that material. It contains an idea we say over and over again. So often, I think, that we don't really find it very easy to take it seriously in our concrete dealings with ourselves, each other, our world. That last line that Dean read was,
"The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this."
Okay, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. And what Isaiah is spelling out there is a conviction we find running from one end of the Bible to the other. And it's a very strange, difficult conviction. What he's saying is, Yahweh shapes history. Yahweh shapes history. God controls history, not man. Okay? And it seems to me just about everything we do as individuals and as a society really works out of the presupposition that man is the one who runs things. Okay? That man is in control. So here we run up against one of the most interesting and important of the biblical ideas, the very basic conviction that God shapes history, not man. We work out of a lot of other kinds of understandings of history. For example, the American Constitution is written basically out of a deistic view of history that says, going quickly with this, something like this. There is a God, he made things, he set things up, but after he set things up, he retired. Sometime the image is used, he's like a clockmaker. He made the clock, the cosmos, and so on. And then he left. And he left people with their minds in control. Man with his reason can make any adjustments he needs. And our Constitution is written out of that conviction. Really, the conviction of an absentee God. Okay? Man with his reason can make any adjustments necessary. That's not the biblical view, because the biblical God is not an absentee God. And man with his reason is not in control. Another basic view of history in our time is the Marxist view. The basic forces are the materialistic forces organized in terms of production and consumption. And of course, Marx borrows in Hegel's ideas and says history works like so, triangles, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And the forces work rather mechanistically towards ultimately a classless society. Another very common understanding of history, a couple of them, deistic view, a Marxist view. It seems to me another very common view of history that bobbed up towards the surface during the whole business with Watergate was what we call a nihilistic view of history. I think an awful lot of people in Western culture in our time really border on the idea that history is without rhyme or reason. Like it says in Macbeth, a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury and signifying nothing. I think that each individual in his own life sometimes feels maybe that's it. And I think there are an awful lot of people in our culture really on the edge of a nihilistic view of history. No rhyme or reason, finally nothing makes sense. So Marxism, deism, a nihilistic view. But the biblical view then, one God moves things along a line towards a goal. God shapes history. Okay, again, we're pressed for time. I know some of you will be leaving over the weekend, so I'd like to just sketch out some different understandings of that idea that God shapes history. It seems to me to be Christian to try to live out of the biblical understanding of things is to put that conviction at the center of the whole of my living. God shapes history, not man. But what does that mean? Is to put that conviction at the center of the whole of my living. God shapes history, not man. But what does that mean? Now again, this problem of choices. There are a lot of different choices in trying to understand and come to grips with that idea that God shapes history. This is a topic I work with at some length in some of my classes back at Capitol. And I have one student there that I've had in some of my classes who finds it very entertaining to send my name into all sorts of lists and various organizations and different kinds of churches and evangelists and so on.
But she's put me on the list of one fellow, and I'll leave his name out of it, but about once every 2 weeks I get a mailing from him. And he works out of the idea that God shapes history. Well, putting the best construction on what he says and does, this is what he thinks. But his interpretation of the idea that God shapes history is like this. If you pray and send some money to brother such and such, God will answer your prayers and enter magically into history. He always has gimmicks and letters of one kind or another, but letters like this, letters of people who have tried what brother such and such says and got results. I wanted this house. It cost $30,000. I'm quoting one of the letters now. It cost $30,000. I didn't have any money. I sent you $5 and asked you to pray for me. I went down to the real estate agent, and he gave it to me for $15,000 with no down payment. Brother such and such. I needed a new car. I didn't have any money. I prayed, sent you money, you prayed for me, and so on. I got a new $4,000. This is back some time. Station wagon. Okay, but letter after letter like that. And somehow or other, it's always tied to giving some money to Brother Al. One letter that I got there even said, if you have to borrow the money, that's okay, because you'll get 50-100-fold return on your investment with, okay. That's the grossest one I've ever run into, okay. I don't know how to label it fairly and not caricature it. I guess the best I could do would be to say it's kind of a magical understanding of how God works in history. Now, I have no objection or no fault whatsoever in thinking that God works outside the laws of nature. It seems to me to have any understanding of God is to say he's not confined within laws of nature. But the problem is that we tend to, with that kind of thinking, very often limit God to doing things outside the laws of nature rather than seeing him working within them. So one understanding of how God works in history, a magical or a supernaturalistic view, that I think is too limiting. Not necessarily wrong throughout, but too limiting. Pushing the activity of God off into what I would call the magical or supernatural. Another near relative of that understanding of how God works in history, I would label like this. He did and he will. He did and he will. He used to do magical, supernatural things in the past. The parting of the Red Seas, Jesus walking on water, and so on. And he will in the future. Someday the cosmos will come crashing down, and God will enter in on the clouds of heaven, and so on. We're sort of stuck in between. We have a book that talks about what he did magically and supernaturally in the past, and predicts what he will do magically and supernaturally in the future, but we're caught in between with only a few reminders now and then. And I think that's quite a common understanding when all is said and done of how God works in history. He did things, weird and wonderful things in the past, and he will in the future. Maybe a few reminders now and then, but basically what's expected of us is to believe he did in the past, and that gets us ready for in the future. I think it's only a little ways away from that other one, that other view of God in history I was talking about. Another understanding of God in history with a long, complex history, we usually label predestination. God has predetermined what, for example, the 20th century will be like. Or he has predetermined and pre-shaped what I'll be like, what you'll be like, and so on. I wish we had more time to go into where that came from. First of all, with somebody like Augustine, it was a way of comforting people. Augustine used that predestination idea as a way of saying, look, God has chosen you. But in the post-Reformation period, it got to be a kind of double predestination. There ain't nothing you can do about it. Somebody's chosen to go to heaven, some to go to hell, and so on. How do you tell which way you're going? And out of that emerged the work ethic. Success in your vocation is a good indication, etc. But predestination, then, is another understanding of how God works in history. A very popular understanding over the last century in biblical studies is what's called a Heilsgeschichtliche understanding of history, or a holy history understanding. The imagery is like this. History is a great big broad river. Within this river there's one special current that gives shape and direction to everything else. That special current is the history of Israel in Old Testament times and the history of the church since. So God doesn't work all over. He works within Israel and the church to give shape and direction to everything else. Okay, listing those, then what I labeled magical, then he did and he will, then predestination, then special stream. For myself, I think again those are choices, but for myself, not choices that I could make. As we look at biblical stuff, it seems to me that always there's an emphasis like this. God is in everybody's history, not just some folks, but in everybody's history. Amos, for example, deals with that. Israel, some in Israel are kind of cocky. They say, look, God chose us, the Exodus. And Amos says, big deal. He brought you out of Egypt, he brought the Syrians out of Kaftor, and so on. Saying, God works in everybody's history. He works in everybody's history all the time, and he works in history in such a way that we're still responsible. Paul in Romans, the first couple of chapters, makes this very clear. And he concludes by saying, everybody's without excuse. Everybody's without excuse. However it is that God works in history, he does it for everybody all the time in such a way that we retain our responsibility. And it seems to me those understandings of history that I was sketching out, by my thinking, don't meet those criteria. Everybody's history all the time in such a way that I'm responsible. So one final viewpoint, one final understanding of what it means to say that God works in history. God works in history by way of dialogue. The label I would use for it, dialogue. Augustine says, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in God. Herbert Brown, a contemporary Swiss theologian, says, God is the ground of our being. You've heard, many of you, that phrase out of Tillich, God is the ground of our being. But Brown says it this way. He says, God is the ground of our being agitated. God is the ground of our being agitated. Another little glimpse at that idea. Francis Thompson, the British poet, poem, The Hound of Heaven. He says, God is like a hunting hound who keeps chasing us, bugging us, asking us who we are. And our lives, individually and corporately, are a conversation between God and us. God, through the ordinary events of everyday life, forces on us the question, who are you? And when we give phony answers, he keeps bugging us. He chases us until we give honest answers, true answers to the question, who are you? So history is dialogue. God is the one who forces on us the questions of our identity, direction, who are you? And chases us until we give true answers. And I think then God does this not necessarily through violations of laws of nature, but more commonly through the ordinary events of everyday life. That put to us, how do you answer? Who are you? Does that really make sense? A thing you might read there in looking at that last idea that's really fun to look at, a short story by Flannery O'Connor, a very interesting contemporary American writer, Flannery O'Connor, and the short story is Revelation. For helping flesh out that idea that God works through ordinary events to bug us into honest answers to the question, who are you? Her short story is a fine one for looking at that idea. But then choices. Choices in our understanding of Isaiah 9, we could go into more choices than the few we looked at. A prediction, a statement of hope in his own time, a combination of the two. So much depends on the tools we take into the study. But the focus comes down on the question of the theological importance of Isaiah for us. And I think there, particularly that last line, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this, the conviction that God shapes history. What does it mean to say that God shapes history? Again, it's only one understanding of history out of many, and different understandings of the idea that God shapes history. A deistic view, he did and then he retired. A magical view, he did and will kind of thing. A special stream, predestination. And finally, the idea of dialogue. Okay, any last words? Our time is up here.
There's one place in the New Testament, I don't remember the exact location, where Jesus is reading from the scrolls, and he says, today I say this has come true. And how does that fit in with this not being a, you know, prophecy or prediction?
I think that the idea of coming true or fulfillment can be seen as fulfillment of prediction or fulfillment of expectation. Okay? And I would say fulfillment of expectation. These things we've been hoping about, expecting. Again, our time is so limited, but if we had time, we'd take the passage where Matthew quotes Isaiah, that passage in Isaiah. And I think instead of seeing Matthew saying, look, Isaiah predicted, now it's happened, Matthew saying, look, we've hoped and dreamed about this all the time. Now, in and through Jesus and his teaching, it becomes a real life possibility for us, a fulfillment of expectation rather than prediction. Okay? Yeah, we'll have to close.